Right. What I want to do here is summarize the work we've been doing on quantum kinetic theory. As you can see, I'm from Victoria University of Wellington. I can translate the rest to you later. And I have also the co-workers Peter Zoller and Dieter Jaksch, who are in Innsbruck, Austria. Rob Ballard, who's in Otago University, also in New Zealand, about 1,000 kilometers away. Matthew Davis, who's managed to shift from Otago to Oxford in England, and Mark Lee, who's also with me in Victoria University. And Dieter and Mark presented posters which amplified to some extent the things that I'm going to talk about here in some of the more detailed parts. Now, the question one should ask is what indeed is a quantum kinetic theory? And I don't really wish to... do we have a better focus on this? Put so much effort into printing these slides, they should be focused perfectly. What a quantum kinetic theory is, of course, has many possible definitions. So I'm talking about the one that I want to talk about here and that we've done all the work on. Kinetic theories have been normally thought of as purely random processes just involving numbers of particles, but what we need here is something that actually combines coherence in quantum mechanics, which is essential for understanding Bose-Einstein condensation. But at the same time, all these kinetic processes, which if you talk to anyone who actually makes a Bose-Einstein condensate, will tell you very definitely that these things do happen and this is how the evaporative cooling takes place. And all this should be done in a way in which the thermalization and randomization is consistent with the coherence. So we have this idea that we'll divide the atoms in a trap. Now, I draw this as a parabolic trap, which is what everyone has used, even though theoretically it would be much nicer to have a little dimple trap, which Wolfgang has just made. So the theory for that would be much easier. But here, we more or less arbitrarily say above something that we call Emax, which should be something of the order of the chemical potential. Everything is thermalized. Below here, we talk about the levels in the trap. And one aspect that is very important to notice is that when you start off with no condensate, your parabolic potential may look like that, starting, say, at zero. But by the time you have N-naught particles in the condensate, this must have risen up an amount equal to the chemical potential. Now, how to interpolate between this is the work of people like Svengari, Graham, Chordash, and Sepelussi. In the cases that we've been dealing with, largely we have not worried too much about the details of how that is done. The really significant point is that up here the potential has not changed much, down here it is. If you have a perfectly square well, that's not quite true. But in this kind of well, the interaction does actually become completely negligible at high energy levels. Okay, now people have asked me where are these papers and so on, so let's say exactly what we have done and exactly what we are doing. We won't try too much to go into what we will do. We wrote first this quantum kinetic theory one. I should point out these were intended to be one paper to begin with. Every paper has grown as the part that we felt we couldn't do of the previous one. We wanted really to work out some way of doing kinetic theory and providing coherences. Now, in this case, we dealt without any trapping potential, and I think in some sense it's been one of the problems in all the BEC work that the instinct has been to look towards the homogeneous case as being the simplest thing, and then perhaps start looking at the trap. Well, by the time we've finished all this without the trapping potential, nonlinear terms, it was becoming clear that perhaps the situation really was the other way around. These traps really do simplify things a lot because you have a well-defined energy level structure, whereas in an infinite homogeneous system, the levels are so close together, you can't really separate out kinetics from coherent processes nearly so easily. This one, which is the work largely done by Dieter Jaksch, looked simply at stochastic process is simply, was an equation derived from this process, just an ordinary probabilistic equation, and studied some of the fluctuations which occurred just as a result of Bose statistics. Now, the QK3 is what really is the central part of what I want to talk about today. And the essence in this one is to treat all the higher energy particles simply as a bath of particles, and the lower energy ones are treated fully quantum mechanically. So that is a grand canonical treatment. It's simplified, it's appropriate for dealing with some of the experiments on growth, but not all of them. D.T. Yach did a lot more calculations here. We want to point out that the kinetic equation here can also deal with coherences, and we calculated correlation functions, the time over which you should expect, what should we call it, the correlation time of the Bose-Einstein condensate. There are several effects in there. Now, these two are underway. This is really going to be, it's nearly finished now, and there we really do treat the condensate and the non-condensate in interaction with each other. Each influences the other, and the numbers, relative numbers, are not so important. There's still some detail in making this, shall we say, comprehensible. QK6, we're working out, based on the QK3, we also worked out this growth equation for the condensate, and that appeared to look very much like what was observed experimentally. But the QK6 includes a lot of corrections, and all I can say is this looks more like what is observed experimentally. It grows a little bit faster, but at the moment there's still some work to be done in actually getting all the details right, because once you start putting in corrections to a simple theory, there is simply a lot more information required to actually evaluate the corrections. So I think we can say that the results we get from that are, shall we say, in the right ballpark, but the anomalous temperature dependence that Wolfgang was talking about is possibly still a mystery to me. I'm quite confident that in the long run there will be no difficulty in getting everything to agree, but some of the theoretical treatment has a range of validity which seems not to actually cover the full range over which the experiments have been done. Okay, now just summarizing this slide tells what have we actually done, that is, what are the results other than the set of pieces of paper in Physical Review. This is, I think, the main result, this growth equation. And this is just what I've commented here. I think that this equation is in its very simplest. The basic thing here is showing how the condensate grows. The quantity W plus, which depends on a lot of things, is not so easy to characterize with any precision. It involves a lot of calculation. But the thing that I think is almost certainly correct is the fact that the saturation arises as the chemical potential of the condensate, this one, mu n, approaches the chemical potential of the vapor, which is mu. And essentially, therefore, you have stimulated processes multiplied by n and a spontaneous process. When we generalize this, you'll find there are many, many extra parts to be added, but they all have some general structure like that one. Now, again, this is, shall we say, something in which you've boiled off all the complications possible, come down to the crudest, simplest possible case. What I should also emphasize is this describes, remember I said that the vapor is regarded as a bath at a fixed chemical potential, mu, which is what Wolfgang's experiments did their best to actually simulate, and seems to be quite accurately true there, since it's only a small proportion of condensate. And then this is set up with most of the bath at that chemical potential. Then all the lower levels, something else. For simplicity, we put them all equal to zero, but you can treat different initial conditions. So this is not the idea of growing just near the critical point. This is well past the critical point and is a process that is not really described very well by expansions around the critical point. Okay, I think I'll carry on a little further now. Basic outline of what we're doing. We're taking the Hamiltonian everyone takes. This is effectively a pseudo-potential. Another way of looking at pseudo-potentials, that is, it is a short-range potential which gives the right scattering length, but not a too short a range. Essentially, though, we're just using the normal pseudo-potential approach, where this is U by delta X minus X prime. And the notation, here I want to get some of this done here. The RNC I call the non-condensate band here. That's everything which is going to be assumed to be thermalized and a given chemical potential. And here you describe in terms of distinct track levels the RC. The field operator psi of X, this one shall we say, here can be written as phi plus psi NC. So phi is the field operator for everything in here and psi is the field operator for everything in here. You just divide them in half. They don't have quite the nicest commutation relations, but they do commute with each other. Okay, now having done that, it's now a process of eliminating lots of things we are not interested in. The general idea, which is something that has been applied in quantum optics for many years, is to eliminate rapidly relaxing quantities. And the name of the game is deciding which are rapidly relaxing and which are not. Now, there's various possibilities, and you get hierarchies of relaxation times, which I don't want to go to in detail. So all I'm describing here is what we did. I think the justification for some of these timescale assumptions that one makes to eliminate some of these rapidly relaxing quantities can be quite intricate, and presumably sometimes they're justified and sometimes they're not. In the end, I think my belief in all of this is it's best to go ahead on these assumptions, work out the results, and check whether everything in the end comes out consistently. I think somehow one can object to these for a very long time, in much the same way as people objected to the Boltzmann equation for years and years and years, but people still kept on using it. The Boltzmann equation has its limitations, but these are not in the minds of the users. In other words, let's carry on and we'll go back and check things retrospectively if necessary. All I can say is Boltzmann in the end took his own life over these things. I am not going to. I will stay around. Okay, so in QK3 we eliminated everything up in the non-condensate band. Just consider it to be a constant, then derive a master equation with various other assumptions but of not such great significance. In the QK1 and QK5 we're much more careful. Now the QK1 is nice in that you don't have to worry about the effects of a potential. So we eliminated coherences between bands of different momenta. We assumed, therefore, that essentially we divide the space up into bands and spatially momenta space into bands and coordinate space also into boxes. And we would eliminate the coherences between different momenta, but not between different places. This gives some very nice equations, but in the end I think was not really that relevant to some of the things we want to do for condensate growth. But nevertheless, in QK5 the whole process is carried through simultaneously in the condensate band where we look at specific energy levels, and the non-condensate band where we look at this wavelet expansion, doing much the same thing as in the original homogeneous situation. So we're eliminating essentially all but the And as well in the QKA5 have carried out a second stage of elimination, that is essentially reduce the kinetics in the non-condensate band to something like the quantum Boltzmann equation, and thereby getting a coupling of the QK3 description, which is how the condensate grows, with the dynamics of the vapor. Now that's not really finished yet, but it will get finished. Now the most significant thing that I think is absolutely necessary is how to describe those states which are actually in the condensate. The Bogoliubov description gives a very nice description of the spectrum, but the traditionally carried out, the assumption is that the condensate is not significantly depleted, or it's treated as simply being characterized by chemical potential. And the whole process, if we wish to look at how a condensate grows, then if you're going to ask how does this number increase, it is important to know what the number is before you talk about whether it's going to increase or not. So it's important to have a description of the condensate energy levels in a way in which we can simultaneously get a nice approximation to the energy levels and nevertheless attribute a well-defined number of particles to that. And so the particle number conserving description is necessary. Now, after this one was worked out, Marvin Giraudot pointed out that in fact there is an alternative that he worked on a long time ago. It would be possible to use his description as well, but the essence of it is not so much what is the spectrum. The exact nature of the spectrum is not too important. You can approximate it, but you must be able to write the field operator for the condensate band in the form in which here is an overall destruction operator for the total number of particles in this band of energy levels. And here is your wave function for the condensate. And these little b's are also operators, but they describe the creation and destruction of quasi-particles in the sense of phonons. That is, they are rearrangements of the particles in the condensate band. They are not particle operators themselves. Now, this is not exact, of course. It can't be done exactly, not at the same time as these should be creation and destruction operators with exact commutation relations. But it can be done to a degree of approximation that is as good as the usual Bogoliubov description. So for every number n of particles in this band, we can say this is the possible energy levels that you could have. Now, the wave function psi is then obeys the time-independent Gross-Pitiyevsky equation. Psi depends on n. The mu n is the eigenvalue that comes out. There's no other way it's specified. It's simply a number that you get by solving the equation. Whereas the quasi-particles have a spectrum of energies which you can calculate, but I won't go into at the moment. And these amplitudes f and g are for creation and destruction of quasi-particles. Again, these could be calculated. I haven't done them. No one, I think, has done all of these. They're related to the wave functions of that you calculate by the Bogoliubov-Degen equations, but there are some corrections. One is these have to be orthogonal to the condensate wave function. And the other, you have to realize that, now I'm not sure whether I should introduce this since it's sure to cause confusion. The ground state should have, if you should have an n particle state in which the n particles have the wave function corresponding to n particles. The state also exists where there are n plus 1 particles with the wave function corresponding to n particles. And this means that the choice of basis for the ground state depends upon the number of particles that are already there. And this introduces further corrections, which means that the wave function changes as you put things in. So if you just put one particle into the ground state and go up, well, you find that actually you've created some quasi-particles because the ground state has changed as well. These would be very fine corrections.
May I ask you, usually substitution B on a key value...
This is not.
Correction to that is 1 divided n number of the particles.
But we want to watch the particles go in one by one, so we need this correction. You know, particles go in one by one. You do agree?
No,
you don't agree? When you count, you have to keep track of numbers of order 1. We are going to count. I think to comment, perhaps to be a little fairer to Yuri, I should also point out that if you work it all out, yes, the expansion in powers of 1 upon n is consistent. I am not keeping some terms of order 1 upon n and neglecting others. So everything is, this has been thought out, but can't be answered as a simple question. I can give you some references. Now, alternative strategies, just to get things a bit more precise, what we seem to know now as a result of the work of all these workers, and I'm sorry, I haven't got Dr. Chordash in there, but he is also in that one, has spoken on this in the conference. Essentially, the particles can be described as non-interacting above a certain energy. There is a range of energy levels where essentially you could say these behave like particle-like energy levels. The actual phonon-type effect is rather small. These are describable by something like a Hartree-Fock description. And there's only a very small number of levels where the Bogoliubov effect is really significant. And finally, you have the condensate here. And this gap is drawn a little bit bigger just to indicate that really there is some space between the condensate level and the next level up. Now, this would not change the methodology significantly, but it would improve accuracy. Okay, now, I've talked about generalities. Let me just put on something with a little bit more structure, and I'll talk about this. And then we'll talk briefly about what's involved in deriving it. What does this mean? First, look at the pictures. These are pictures that describe processes. This is the part of the condensate that might be described as having, well, it's a condensate band. These are the processes that can occur. A particle can, have I got this right? Yes, this is a particle from the vapor, the green arrow, hits something in the condensate and it knocks that particle out and it still stays out itself. I draw this as just a little wiggle in here because in terms of quasi-particles, it's not clear whether it creates or destroys, but it certainly, this certainly removes one particle in total. It may add a quasi-particle or subtract a quasi-particle. Here is the reverse. These are coded by red in this equation. Here is scattering off the condensate, and here is the less likely process. But because we have a band of energy levels we're talking about here, it is possible to have a three-particle interaction here that actually expels a particle from the condensate, and the reverse is also possible. But almost everyone neglects these terms. If we work and derive a master equation by eliminating the coherences, eliminating the condensate band, we get something here. It's a master equation in three parts. Notice this is an equation for the density operator, so this is a huge Hilbert space operator. Here is a commutator, okay? There, all of that part is commuted with this part. So this describes the Hamiltonian type of evolution. And essentially what you can see here is the Hamiltonian that we started off with, but written in terms of phi. There is some correction because phi has been as only part of the field operator, but that's not big. And as well as this, one finds, of course, a term that arises by here, this F. I mean the actual distribution function, momentum position distribution function of the vapor. So here is a term that is a mean field effect arising on the condensate as a result of particles from the vapor passing through the condensate. So in a sense, this is the standard dynamics. Now this is all the irreversible processes corresponding to particles going from vapor to condensate and back. Here, you divide into two parts. We'll talk about what the actual amplitudes are in a minute. Here you have terms that run in one direction. Here it runs the other. These are very standard quantum optical terms. X and so on are as yet undefined, but they are the X's are projections of parts of the field operator for the condensate. This is projections of bilinear combinations of field operators, the U's are. These V's are projections of trilinear combinations. And these quantities are then averages over all of the bath levels, which have to be worked out and which can be worked out. So you have one part here, nearly everything describes what is happening inside this condensate band, whereas these things all refer to processes, the amplitudes that arise from outside it. Now that looks like a horrible equation. I mean, I've coloured it nicely, but it still doesn't help much. Nevertheless, to get that where you have operator and Hermitian conjugate on the opposite side is not something that comes out automatically and involves things like random phase assumptions or rotating wave assumptions, we would call them in quantum optics. Whatever it is, it's a kind of a decoherence. And it does involve some justification which is not that easy to give in cast iron terms. Now, before I take this one away, now here, coming back to it, it's the same picture, the same processes, the same colour scheme, but different equations which now represent what are these amplitudes. For example, the amplitude here is to, for two particles to collide and one of them to go into the condensate and one to remain outside the condensate. What you see here is the three distribution functions and momentum and position, U is position, arranged so that the energy, this delta omega 1, 2, 3 is the energy transfer, matches up to a value omega, and somewhere or other I've got a momentum transfer factor too, but I seem to have lost track of it. Oh no, it's in here. Because of this, delta K 1, 2, 3 guarantees momentum is conserved as well. Here is the reverse process, similar thing, bilinear now, and similar thing, just linear. But essentially, these things can be worked out, and we assume that those are given by essentially a stationary distribution. Okay, now, they have to be condensed down into something that is a little bit more tractable, and perhaps even a little bit more attractive. Now, I won't go into the details of the assumptions because I think time is going a little faster than I thought it would. I should just comment yet again on the approximations. This is the basic set of approximations. The condensate band has a spectrum which is not greatly changed by interaction with the non-condensate band, but we could improve this by putting in all those interactions. It just changes the spectrum. A Markov approximation, well, lots of arguments go over Markov approximations, but at some level of time scale, which should not probably be too short in the condensates, we must be able to make some kind of Markov approximation. Possibly that can be improved, but everyone who has tried to improve on Markov approximations has normally found the description becomes very complicated. And I mentioned rotating wave or random phase approximation. Those are really all that's necessary. That is, these are not guesses, these are derivations, but guided by intuition, or as Peter Drummond once said to me, magic or witchcraft. He didn't... you wrote it down. You didn't realize I also used voodoo. Now, the basic transformation, this really describes how the process has come about. Essentially, to get this describes, say, these X operators. The field operator is divided up into parts which you can say are eigen operators of the Hamiltonian for the condensate band. So essentially, they're divided up into parts which create or destroy condensate band particles of certain energies. And this description is normally given, say, in a free field operator, it's just the ordinary expansion terms of creation and destruction operators. Here, though, we have to take account of the fact that the wave functions change, they depend on N, and so you have a different resolution for every possible number of particles in the condensate. But you can say there are these operators, I'll label them by naught M, which says this creates this will put a particle into the condensate and create no quasiparticles, and the eigenvalue is actually minus the chemical potential. This is a destruction operator. The creation operator has it round the other way. And so this is the resolution into these X's is equivalent essentially to the resolution we had before using that modified Bogle-Yubov method of the field operator. If you want to do the bilinear and the trilinear parts, it's very much more complicated, but in principle the same. So parts involving the X's turn into parts involving phi rho, phi dagger. You then perhaps put in this expansion, and a term you might get out is the one involving only fewer condensate terms, which I've written here, which will involve the wave functions that you've got here of the number of particles you're talking about, and these creation destruction operators, the B dagger Bs, which also depend on N. There is the density operator. These are just functions. There is the operator that creates, or in this case actually destroys, particles in the vapor. So in the end, you get this down to something that, in essence, the elementary part is a master equation involving only one set of operators. If you want to forget about the quasiparticles, then you can actually make this look relatively simple. And so, essentially, what you'll get in the end is a growth of the condensate, something in which collisions will give you the six main processes. That is no change in the number of quasiparticles, but n goes to n plus or minus 1, creating a quasiparticle, absorbing a quasiparticle. And the amplitudes can be written down. This delta is something which hides all the momentum and energy conservation. Don't worry about it too much. Essentially, we're saying multiply together the phase space density functions at the appropriate positions and momentum, and then put in a stimulated factor for the final one. But then, since everything in the condensate band has been handled by the master equation, what actually turns up here is the Wigner function of the wave function of the condensate, which I'm calling Y at this stage. So you have a state, what you've got then is this overlapping distributions. The particles must come in, collide at more or less at the same place, create another particle in the vapor at the same place, and that gives the amplitude to actually create this particular wave function Y, which in the case of the condensate would be the condensate wave function. Momentum and energy have to be conserved. And the picture that you would get out of this is one that I'll just come to here. The essential process that is taking place, you can say, is here, that collisions occur between particles, thermal particles. They're only the collisions that happen where there is the condensate wave function, that is where the condensate will form matter. Energy and momentum must be conserved, since the energy and momentum of the condensate wave function are more or less zero. This means, according to classical billiard theory, these things must come in at right angles. One must go off there, and this one is left sitting in the condensate. The amplitude is given by convoluting all the appropriate distribution functions with the Wigner function of the condensate. And you'll get that one the process to increase, to actually put a particle in, has got a stimulated rate, and the reverse process has also got a stimulated rate. But because this is assumed to be all in a thermal equilibrium with a chemical potential mu, temperature T, there is a relationship between the forward and the backward rate, which is given by this difference of chemical potential. This one arises from the energy conservation. This one arises from the distribution function you assumed. So you've got here, the mu here is a classical type of chemical potential. It's nearly all determined by entropy, whereas mu here is a more chemical potential that's determined almost entirely by energy. Nevertheless, because this is statistical mechanics, when you get to equilibrium, these things have to balance. The process then, you would say, the essential process of condensate growth, well, I could write that as a probabilistic process, but I won't talk about that very much, is that on the whole, once things get going, the stimulated factor is so strong the particles simply go from one to the next ground state level, with occasional situations where you might absorb one from a quasi-particle level, or you might put one in a quasi-particle level. Now, of course, there are processes going in the other direction as well, but as the condensate grows, these ones, processes going in the other direction, are just not as common as the ones that increase the condensate, and eventually they balance out, and then the condensate sits there. And if you're not in, you know, if you can do things quickly enough, that's quite long enough to do the solution. Okay, now in getting an elementary and simple equation, the one I wrote before, you neglect everything that you can. Okay, all fluctuations, all quasi-particle effects, we use the Buxwell-Boltzmann distribution function. We treat it, as I said before, the non-condensed atoms. This is just not depleted. If you do all those things, then finally this comes down to the simple growth equation. And I love this formula with the Bessel function. It's sad, however, that in practice this whole factor equals about one. But it is a nice thing. I mean, I was proud that we could do that integral. And this is the we published in Physical Review Letters last year. This is the exact graph. At this stage, you see the growth. This is given for 2,000 rubidium atoms or about 500,000 sodium. This is too slow. The result basically is that this factor, which is done assuming just Maxwell-Boltzmann statistics, is really just impossibly, well, not impossibly slow, but it's too slow by a factor of about 4. It is unfortunate that we made a calculational error to begin with, and this was a factor of 4. So it looked like it fitted better than it should have. Well, we can do improvements to the model, like using the full Bose-Einstein, including the quasi-particle effects, including the modification of the spectrum, including all the scattering between quasi-particle levels. And this is the content of the poster with Mark Lee, in which the effects, there are two principal effects that really do come in. One of them is to include the fact, this is what we did before. These are the growth terms, the particles just dropping down to the various levels. But if you include all these levels, you must include the possible scattering of the quasi-particle levels with particles in the vapor. Putting these together, now principally just accounting for the fact that the distribution function here should be not Maxwell-Boltzmann or Bose-Einstein, this gives you a speed up from green to red. And if you put these effects in, you get speed up from red to purple. Now, these look very similar. We've assumed 500 atoms initially in the condensate, but that surprisingly doesn't make much difference. 0 to 500, these graphs look pretty well the same. At this stage, we've only done spherically symmetric condensates, but using better models for the energy levels and so on, I think we're hopeful of getting some quite good fits in the long run. Okay, other things I just want to comment. This is just the point is that, yes, the equilibrium distribution of the condensate comes out, as you'd expect, from the grand canonical ensemble in quantum mechanics. You just solve the stochastic equations, you can get the equilibrium distribution. They satisfy detailed balance, so every process in all the equations that are ever written here will always be consistent with this being the stationary distribution function, in the limit, therefore, that, well, it depends. At this stage, I've only put in the first order corrections to the energies. You've got to get the right energies, of course. In other words, describe the spectrum correctly, you'll get the right distribution function. But it is grand canonical, so the variance is given by KT over the derivative of the chemical potential with respect to number. We get that as proportional to n to the 3/5. Now, Sandro Spingari has a completely different limit, which is very low temperature. This is effectively high temperature. Oh, there's one. I don't see any contradiction between these, but it's still got to be put down in writing exactly how these match up. Finally, I just noticed that we can also deal with the phase diffusion, the dephasing of the condensate. This is, in fact, in its simplest form, I just want to note here that this is what we'd like to calculate, the time, two-time, two-place correlation function. There's something wrong in this equation here. The point I want to say is, though, that this is equivalent to calculating a correlation function of just the operators B with an evolution operator. If you work through the equations, essentially, apart from lots and lots of corrections, which we have put in, you'll get here, firstly, the chemical potential oscillation, a damping due to effectively the noise term, that is the sum of the rates of the processes back and forth, another damping due to, well, this is actually a forward-backward term. I don't have time to explain it. But the point is, what you get is damping terms here. At short times, this is Gaussian in practice. At long times, it becomes exponential. It's consistent in a certain limit with the work done by Levenstein and Yu and so on. But we also included, and this one is a poster I stole from D.T. Yaksha's poster. As you can see, he has a different philosophy and color schemes from me. The things that are included in the master equation I've been talking about now are these two. That is, this is the growth where one drops into the condensate. This is the bouncing off where one hits one and they stay like that. The third term is not really considered at all. But phenomenologically, that is adding in similar terms, we put in one particle loss by, say, something from outside the trap, knocking something out, two particle loss and three particle loss just to work out all the effects on the phase. Now, all we need now is someone, firstly, to measure the phase and its relaxation time, and then perhaps we would be able to get to work and calculate exactly what these things are. As it is, the calculation is, shall we say, schematic. There are things there that really you have to evaluate experimentally to make sure you could match them up. Okay, well, I think I'll stop at that. Thanks very much.
Hey, you mentioned that the model wasn't fitted to the critical temperature. I was wondering why.
I think what I really meant is models near the critical temperature don't necessarily match up with it. What I'm saying is there's no assumption on the critical temperature. I doubt whether experiments are going to be very relevant to models based upon working around the critical temperature. All I really was saying is this isn't done around the critical temperature and does not use that assumption. I've not really got any comment to make on what I think one would get from this model on the critical temperature. How fast does the condensate grow at the critical temperature? Have you done that experiment?
Yes.
Yeah. You have?
I looked at it using the Klein-Boltzmann equation, and it grows very slowly initially.
Well, I meant in your experiments. Okay. I meant in your experiments.
Experimentally. We're looking at that.
Yeah. I should point out that the simple growth equation you could extract out of the Klein-Boltzmann equation as well, provided you put in the fact that the energy levels are going to change as the chemical potential increases. That's the principal thing that comes in. So in terms of models based on the quantum Boltzmann equation, the sort of things you are doing which have essentially no chemical potential correction.